The Fifth Kind. This video is in association with Portal to Ascension. Visit www.portaltoascension.org for access to thousands of interviews, conferences, and live events. Michael Cremo is a researcher of human origins and an international authority on archaeological anomalies. He has authored several books, including the best-selling Forbidden Archaeology, in which he argues the existence of humans on Earth as long as 40 million years ago. The Forbidden Archaeologist, Human De-Evolution, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, and The Hidden History of the Human Race, co-authored with Richard Thompson. Michael has been invited to present his research in some of the leading scientific institutions of the world, such as the Royal Institution of London, the Russian Academy of Science, the Moscow Department of Anthropology, the Indian Institute of Science, and many others. His work in archaeology and research of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India has revealed a long and mysterious history of human origins.
I'm going to speak for a while, and then there'll be time for questions and answers. I'm a researcher in human origins for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And my work is based on my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the Puranas, which are the Vedic histories and cosmologies. And I've been able to integrate my Vedic commitments with science. And I've presented many papers in which I integrate the Vedas and science. This book, which has been available this week, is My Science, My Religion. It's a collection of 24 papers that I presented at mainstream academic and scientific conferences, integrating my science and my religion. So, why do I say my science and my religion? Some scholars of history of science and religion has said the perceived relation between science and religion depends on how both of these terms are defined, when and by whom. Because there are many varieties of science and there's many varieties of religion. You can't just speak about science and religion in a general way. So These scholars say we must ask the question, whose science and whose religion? So, my science is a science informed by Vedic teachings. And the science that I'm dealing with is based on materialist conceptions of reality. So there's some conflict between them. My guru would say, religion without philosophical basis is, without scientific basis, is sentiment. That religion based on philosophy and science, that is right. And that's something echoed by Einstein. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. So although many scientists think that spirituality and science are two separate things that have to be kept apart, some of the greatest scientists have realized that the two must cooperate with each other. to understand the relationship between Vedic spirituality and science, we have to understand something about the Vedic epistemology. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy that deals with how we know things, what is considered to be evidence. According to the Vedic epistemology, there are two paths of knowledge, the ascending path and the descending path. The ascending path is based on two kinds of evidence, sense perception and logical inference. In other words, scientists look with their senses or with instruments that extend their senses and gather perceptions. And then they reason about it. If this is like this, then it must be like that. But this is an imperfect way of getting knowledge about things that are actually quite distant from us in time and space. If we're talking about just things that we can manipulate in our laboratories here on Earth, then this method might work. But when we're talking about what happened billions of years ago, or things that happened in distant galaxies and things of that sort, this method doesn't apply very well, because the senses that we use to perceive things are very limited, and the mind that we use for logic can make mistakes, become illusioned, and so forth. So, to know things that are beyond our immediate range of sense perception and beyond our mental constructs of logic, there's another path of knowledge, the descending path of knowledge, which is based on the idea that there is a supreme, intelligent, personal source of everything. And this source can communicate truths to human society, transmit these truths through sound vibration. Of course, the sound vibration can be encoded in words. So that's what the Vedic literature is. It's sound vibration coded into words that store those sound vibrations. Some of the great spiritual teachers in the Vedic system of thought have said that if there is evidence that comes from pratyaksha, or sense perception, and anumana, logical inference, it can be used to lead people to the correct understanding of the actual situation by hearing about it from the Vedic sources and justifying it with appropriate logic and information that are consistent with it. So, in that way, it's possible to blend science and religion. So that's basically what I've done. I've used sense evidence and logic in the service of the descending path of knowledge based on shabda, transcendental sound vibration. And I use that scientific evidence and logic to support the Vedic conclusions. So by my science, I mean scientific evidence and logic consistent with the Vedic conclusions. And my religion By my religion, I mean the Vedic conclusions as I received them from my guru, Srila Prabhupada. So, some of the topics that I deal with have to do with cosmology. According to modern science, our universe is the result of some fluctuation of the quantum mechanical vacuum, whereby some particle, some singularity, where everything is concentrated in a single tiny spot, begins to expand. But they've been unable to explain how that leads to the fantastic variety that we see all around us. We see so many types of animals and plants. We see regular order in the movement of the stars and planets. And on the microscopic level, we see that there's tremendous organization among atoms and molecules to build very complex structures. So the universe appears to be very finely tuned for life to exist in it. There are some constants and values of different kinds of ratios of natural forces that are set to very precise values. And if they were even slightly different, if these ratios of natural forces were even slightly different, then we wouldn't have a universe. For example, there's the ratio of the mass of the proton to the mass of the electron. It's set to a very precise value. 1836.17 is the ratio of the mass of the electron to the mass of the proton. If it were even slightly different, we wouldn't have stable atoms. And if there weren't stable atoms, there wouldn't be stars, there wouldn't be planets, there wouldn't be life. And there are many such constants, physical constants, that are set to very precise numerical values. This is the Royal Astronomer of Great Britain, Sir Martin Rees. He wrote, "These six numbers constitute a recipe for a universe. If any one of them were to be untuned, there would be no stars and no life." So, to get around the idea that that fine tuning must be due to some conscious, intelligent source, they propose that actually there are millions of universes being generated, and in each of the values for these constants vary, and we just happen to live in the one in which they're all set right. In other words, we've won the lottery, you know, they would say. You know, but that's still very speculative, because they can't see these other universes, and maybe in all of them there's life, which takes you back to the idea there's some intelligent creator. And that's actually what we learn from the Vedic sources of knowledge, that yes, there are millions of universes. They expand from the form of Mahavishnu, and in all of them, there is life. So they can't contradict that because they aren't able to perceive these other universes to tell whether they have life in them or not. So the conclusion is our universe and many others were deliberately created by the Supreme Conscious Source, who is known in the Vedas as Krishna. The universes expand from the form of Mahavishnu when he breathes out. When he breathes in, the universes come back. And today there are many scientists who believe that the universes start out small and they expand in what they call the Big Bang cosmology. But there are also some scientists who understand that after expanding, the universes contract. Some of them believe that the universe will just keep expanding, expanding, expanding until it finally dissipates and everything will grow cold. Some maintain that the universes expand to a certain point and then remain at that point. Whereas others think the universes expand and then they contract. And I would say that's the actual true situation that's given in the Vedic text. One thing I've always found very interesting is that many of the ancient wisdom traditions talk about the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And you know, some people think, well, this is very primitive and it's not correct. When we talk about elements today, we think about the elements like iron and phosphorus and calcium and helium and hydrogen and so forth. So they think, well, there's no correspondence between the five traditional elements and modern science. But if you look at modern science, they also have, in addition to their elements, chemical elements, they have five states of matter. And the five states of matter are space, gas, plasma, and liquid. So that corresponds to space at the bottom there, corresponds to ether. And and air corresponds to gas. And fire corresponds to plasma. A plasma is a superheated gas. They believe the stars are plasma. Very hot, superheated gas. And then comes liquid, the liquid state of matter that corresponds to water. And then the solid state of matter, which corresponds to earth. So there is some correspondence there. And there's also a correspondence in terms of the order in which they are appearing. According to modern science, the first thing that happens is there's creation of space-time, space. And the Big Bang, the expansion of some particle, virtual particle in the quantum mechanical vacuum, its initial expansion results in space being created. And then as it expands further, the energies begin to coalesce into subatomic particles, and then they turn into atoms. And the first atoms that are produced are, the first one is hydrogen, which has one proton, one electron. And hydrogen coalesces into masses. Well, the hydrogen exists in a gaseous form, and that corresponds to air, which is the next element up. And then the hydrogen gas coalesces, and when it coalesces, it condenses to a very great degree, it ignites into a plasma, and that's a star, and that corresponds to fire. And then the next generation of stars has denser gases like hydrogen, and then even denser gases like oxygen. Yet with each generation of stars, a heavier element is developed. And so sometimes you wonder, well, how can fire produce water? That's an interesting question that I had. Yeah, from the plasma or fire, you get liquid or watery elements. So I recently encountered this report. Apparently, stars are ejecting water into space. And many scientists believe that that's where we get the water that fills the Earth's ocean. It's come to this planet from other places in the cosmos. So, and then from water, you get the denser elements like iron and carbon and things like that. So it's kind of interesting how the modern conception of the origin of universe totally ignores the question of consciousness. They would say that consciousness comes into existence only in the very most recent part of the history of the whole universe. Like within the past couple of million years. And as far as human consciousness and intelligence capable of understanding such things as the origin of the universe, they would say that came into existence only in the past couple of 100,000 years. So they have this idea that the universe began, as you see in the left-hand side there, and then they say that that happened about 13.7 billion years ago. And then for 13 billion years, there was no consciousness at all. And then somehow or other, fairly recently, according to their ideas, consciousness developed. And it was, and across many different species, they had five basic senses: hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and there's one more.
See,
right. So it's kind of interesting that they think matter is so structured that programmed into it, it was programmed in such a way that it would cause the creatures that finally came to exist to have all of these different sensory capacities. Seems like if you were, that requires quite a bit of design, that you're going to start with something that isn't conscious. It's going to remain unconscious for billions of years. And when finally, by chance, the little bits of atomic and molecular structures combine themselves into a living thing that eventually has all these sensory capacities and it works. I mean, we just have to think what kind of intelligence went into producing this computer that can integrate sound and visual impressions and, you know, communicate it to, that can organize those things and display them for different living entities to perceive. That's really quite amazing. But if we have a consciousness-based universe, as we have in the Vedic cosmology, then we see that the elements, the material elements, right from the very beginning, are associated with sense perception, senses and what's perceived by the senses. For example, the ether or space element is associated with sound and a sense of hearing. And there's also a personality who oversees the relationship between the senses, the sense object, and the element that's associated with it. And then the next element, air, is associated with the sense of touch and the sense organs of touch in the skin. And there's also an intelligent being that is overseeing it. And just like here in the presentation of these visual impressions, there's a personality who's in charge of it and making sure that it's working properly. So we have the sensory apparatus, the computer, the projector. We have the observers, yourselves, myself, and a personality overseeing it to make sure it's happening right. Then you have the next element, fire, which is associated with light and the sense of sight. And there's, again, a personality that oversees that to make sure it's all fitting together properly. Then there's the next element, the watery elements that are associated with taste and the tongue, which receives the sense perception of taste. And again, there's a personality, a demigod, Varuna, that oversees it. So we go next to earth, which is associated with odor and smell. And it, again, it's overseen by a demigoddess at this time around, Bhumi, the earth goddess. So in this way, matter in the Vedic cosmology is associated with these senses and the sense objects. And that's why we're able to perceive in these bodies made of matter, because they're organized in such a way that the material elements are associated with sense objects, subtle sense objects, and with subtle senses. And then there's the soul, the Atma, which is the actual perceiver of these sense perceptions. So, And then another topic that I deal with in terms of giving some Vedic insights and integrating them with scientific information is human antiquity. There's the question, how old is the human species? Today, the most common answer to that question comes from the modern followers of Charles Darwin. And they would say the first humans like us came into existence 200 or 300,000 years ago. And before that, there weren't any human beings like us. But the Vedic texts, the Puranas, the historical texts, tell of human civilizations that existed millions of years ago on this planet. And if what the Vedic texts say is true, then we should expect to find reports of evidence in the scientific world showing that humans existed much further in the past than today. Yeah, but if you look at the current textbooks, you don't see any such evidence. But I decided to look beyond the textbooks and look at the original scientific reports. And when I did that, I found something interesting. If you look at these original reports, you see many reports of evidence of humans existing millions of years ago. So I collected that evidence in this book, Forbidden Archaeology. And a question arose in my mind, if this evidence is there in the original scientific reports, why isn't it in today's textbooks? And that's because of a process of knowledge filtration that operates in the world of science. And there are many cases of evidence for this, like the California gold mine discoveries, which their miners discovered human artifacts in layers of rock over 50 million years old. And these were kept in the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. They're not shown to the public, but I got permission to see and photograph them. And there are some of the human artifacts from the California gold mines. We also went out into the mountains of California. This is Table Mountain at the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Central California. And we were able to locate some of the old gold mining tunnels where these objects were originally discovered. So I'd like to go on to another topic here, and then we'll have some time for any questions or comments you want to make. Another question I deal with is the origin of life. Most scientists today say life arose from chemicals. Yeah, they say early in the Earth's history, the chemicals started randomly interacting with each other, and somehow or other, some first self-reproducing organism was produced. But there's no generally accepted explanation of exactly how that happened in science. There are about 30 or 40 different competing theories, and if you look carefully in the scientific literature, you'll see they admit they really don't know how it happened. If they don't know how it happened, I don't see how they can assert that it did happen. For example, this scientist wrote fairly recently, When, where, and how did life on Earth originate? These questions are on the origin of life are among the biggest unsolved problems in natural science. So among themselves, they'll admit we really haven't solved this problem. But to the students of the schools and universities, to the general public, they say with absolute authority that, yes, life comes from chemicals. However, from the Vedic sources, we get the idea that life comes only from life. That you can observe. If you have a living thing, you will see it produces offspring that are also living. So we observe that life comes from life. We never observe that life comes from matter. As a matter of fact, we observe the opposite. We see that matter comes from life. If you have a lemon tree, it produces citric acid. So this is one of the ultimate Vedic truths, that life comes only from life. Another thing they haven't really solved is the origin of the body plants of the different kinds of animals. Now they say, oh, it happened by evolution. If we grant, you have some first single cell reproducing creature, some amoeba or bacteria or something like that, they would say, well, they started clumping together and forming multicellular creatures. And then they say all the other forms evolved. But you see, if you carefully study living things, you'll see there are a lot of different forms. There are starfish that are star-shaped. There are birds that fly, insects that all have six legs, snails and other creatures that have shells. I mean, there are so many radically different kinds of body forms. And if you carefully study the matter, you'll see that scientists admit that this is a big problem. For example, the first quote there, some scientists were writing in a scientific journal, foremost among the unresolved problems confronting modern biology is the origin of biological complexity, most notably that of the shape and form of our own bodies. And the second quotation, among the most interesting and fundamental unanswered questions in biology are, one, how did animal body plans first arise? And two, how have animal body plans remained essentially unchanged since their emergence? Now, here again, in their professional literature among themselves, they admit, we haven't solved this problem. But you go to school, you listen to the teachers in high school or university, you look in the textbooks, they'll say, everything happened by evolution. It's an absolute fact. And if you have any different idea, you're totally wrong. So I would like to see more honesty among scientists about the actual level of certainty we should attach to their conclusions. Now, the final question I'm going to look at is the origin of consciousness. Again, they say it's produced by chemicals in the brain, and they would say, what are we? We're machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival. And that's a pretty grim picture of human origins. And as far as consciousness goes, well, it's produced by chemicals in the brain. but only temporarily. However, in the Vedic teachings, we learn that each conscious self is a part of God. It's eternal. It's never created, never destroyed. This is a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. And the translation of it is, the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Krishna, the personality of Godhead, is the source of all that exists, both matter and spirit, is telling his friend and devotee Arjuna, who had asked him these questions about the origin of the living entities. Krishna is explaining, the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So each of us, as a being of pure consciousness, is actually part of God. So we are God-like in our original pure state of consciousness. But somehow, many people in this world identify totally with the temporary material body. And they struggle very hard with it because the body inevitably becomes old, subject to disease, and eventually is ended. And then the conscious self goes on to another one. So to understand one's real nature as a part of the ultimate supreme conscious being is, again, it's communicated to us by sound vibration. And by sound vibration, we can get realized experience of that. So in a few minutes, we're going to have a demonstration which you could participate in, of experiencing transcendental sound vibrations that put our consciousness in the frequency where it identifies with its eternal nature. And this is the actual purpose of human life, is to raise consciousness to the level where it's no longer subjected to repeated birth and death in this material level of reality. There's a higher level of reality, which is where we really belong. And because we're not in our natural position, we sometimes feel discomfort. We feel something's not quite right about our state of consciousness.
The Portal to Ascension mission officially began in 2008. After 15 years of evolution and thousands of events from live to online and back to live again, there was always an awareness that when we begin creating events internationally, the mission will shift into its next phase. That time is now. Portal to Ascension is traveling to Glastonbury in August 2023 to fulfill this mission. This gathering of incredible luminaries traveling from all over the world to join forces in Avalon is a sacred pilgrimage to these ancient lands, and we invite you to embark on this quest with us. The Portal to Ascension Glastonbury is not only a conference, it is a retreat, a tour, and grid work. Together, we are connecting the powerful mysteries and the ley lines of the heart of Earth, activating and uniting together as one. This three-day event will feature Laura Eisenhower, Anton Parks, Geraldine Orozco, Vivian Chauvet, Sage Oneness, Lori Spagna, and many more. If you Your MCs are Neil Gore, Alan Steinfeld, and Joan of Angels. As a collective, we are waking up from a deep slumber, aligning to our true potential. What will we create? What will we envision? What are the possibilities? Join us in this ancient land for a unique opportunity and a gathering that will activate, elevate, inspire, and uplevel all that attend. August 11th to 13th, 2023. Sign up now at ascensionglastonbury.com.